we've seen essentially a doubling of the number of food animals in the world in about the last 25 years, and it's going to probably double again in the next 20, along with significant concentration of people. So the issue then becomes, how do you keep diseases from transferring?
This is The Public. The Public is a weekly conversation about ideas and undercurrents in Canadian culture on CIUT 89.5. If you like what you hear, or if you don't, we're eager to hear from you. You can find us at thepublicconversation.blogspot.ca or email us at thepublicconversation@gmail.com. This week we're speaking with food industry executive Ted Billier about interspecies infection, the economics of climate change, and the many challenges posed by the project of feeding the human species. Ted Billier was the president of Maple Leaf Foods International and helped establish that company as Canada's largest food exporter by growing market shares in more than 80 countries. He's now a consultant in the sector of agriculture and food production, specializing in innovation. He's the chair of the Canadian Agri-Food Policy Institute, an independent policy forum which identifies emerging issues and advances alternative solutions to challenges facing the agri-food industry. He's also a director of the Alberta Livestock and Meat Association and a member of the board of PreonNet Canada, which is a nationwide network for research into prion and prion-like neurodegenerative diseases in humans and animals. Consequently, he's seen it all, from bovine spongiform encephalopathy, also known as mad cow disease, and Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease as the condition manifests itself in humans, to, more recently, the XL beef crisis and the largest beef recall in Canadian history. He's here today to share his unparalleled experience and his perspective on the challenges we face in feeding the burgeoning human population. Ted, thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure, Michael. It's great to be here.
Was I accurate in summarizing your career in a nutshell, or is there anything you'd like to add or subtract?
No, you could probably shorten it.
All right, well, we'll see what we can do in the editing suite. How's that? So we'll get right into it then. My first question for you is fairly broad. Food is the most basic need for human existence, so I'm wondering, are there any Canadians left who produce their own food in sufficient quantity and diversity to sustain themselves? Any at all?
Well, yes, there's always some people who can literally live off the grid. I think we all know examples of those kind of people. But, in general, our society has, in fact, worldwide, has congregated into cities, and we have not yet found solutions where cities are anything other than food deserts. And I think if we look at the world today, about just over half of the people in the world live in cities, and that essentially means that food has to be somehow brought to them. I'm not convinced that that'll be the way of permanently, but as we sit today, in the 21st century, that's the way it is.
So can you then give us a thumbnail sketch of history of food production from sustenance farming through to factory farming and cities as food deserts, including some of the technological and demographic changes that made the current condition possible?
Well, that's a huge question.
Big question.
I mean, but essentially the big change came when we had a time of where we were able to take certain technologies and apply them and begin producing, for the first time ever, more food than we consumed. The world population was largely held in check, for centuries, because it could never produce enough food. So in the 1800s, basically, we began with modernization of agriculture. I mean, probably the most important piece of it was the steel plow, or the iron plow, where we were able to actually break land that was never used for anything other than grass. It turned into croplands, and we opened up a large part of the North American continent, parts of South America, parts of Africa in that same century, and lo and behold, we were able to essentially increase food production because we were increasing the amount of land. So that was the first major thing. And then later we became expert at getting more yield per acre out of that land, and particularly in the latter part of the 20th century, where we began to apply a lot of new things. We had a green revolution, essentially, which for the first time we saw famine eradicated in many parts of the world, which was very common before. It was very common to have huge famines when crops failed in India and China, places like that. But in that century, we learned particularly in the 50s to apply water and fertilizer, and in later new seeds. But initially, it was just the application of water and fertilizer. And bingo, we had yields jump. And then as we began to get expert in plant breeding, old style plant breeding as it was in those days, we got additional large yields. And so it was a phenomenal change, and it was a step change, in fact. And that was the key factor that allowed population again to surge, and we added billions of people to the earth on the basis of what was an extended green revolution that started in the 50s and grew through to where we are today, where people are now beginning to say, well, maybe we've reached the limits of some of that in for a variety of reasons. But that's that was essentially the application first of certain technologies, that allowed us to open up more land, and then the opening of more land, and then the green revolution issues, which were largely about water and fertilizer, which allowed us to get more yield.
So that is a great description of what's opened up opportunity and allowed for the expansion of the civilization and the species, I should say. I know you've also written and spoken extensively about demographic pressures on the food supply and what will constrain our growth in the future, potentially. Mm-hmm. Not only the number of people who need to eat, certainly, but also urbanization and even relative affluence around the world changing consumption patterns. Would you talk about those factors and how they're changing food production and consumption?
Yes, they're very important. The one of the basic problems is that we have the majority of the people are in countries where we have the least amount of arable land per capita, and the population is increasing in those countries, but the land isn't increasing. So, for example, we have about 29% of the arable land in Asia, but we've got over 53% of the population of the world there. So it's that's a mismatch that's never going to work. And even in the areas where we have quite high yields in some areas, such as coastal China and some parts of Japan, there's no chance that they're going to be able to feed their population by increasing yields where they're already triple cropping. Now, they may be able to do some in more remote areas of those countries where that haven't been fully exploited in a sense yet, but there's a basic mismatch in the arable land and population numbers. So that's the first problem on the supply side. But the demand side is equally challenging, because the population is growing in the cities, so food has to be moved there. But it's becoming relatively affluent in many areas, and the change in income has been startling in Asia and parts of Latin America, even parts of Africa recently. So all these emerging markets are also becoming markets with burgeoning incomes. And as people move from that bottom layer of about $2 a day, and I think that represents something like about 3 billion people. But if they move from under, that around that sustenance level where you're $2 to $3 a day, and I think we have to update the figure. It's probably closer to three than two, simply because the price of food has risen so rapidly in the last 4 years that we really are looking at probably more like $3 a day to get enough nourishment to live on. But in the next category, Let's take it. Sorry, that one first. $2 a day to $3 a day category. We still have nearly three quarters of the people in India in that category, and probably a little less than half the people in China. So we've seen all this amazing development from that other quarter of the people in India and the half of the people in China. So there's much more to come yet, in a sense, as the incomes rise. And they are rising, but particularly in the next category, from, say, $3 to $9 or $10 a day, that's the area where it becomes very significant in terms of people eating more meat, more vegetable oil, fresh vegetables, and dairy products. So as soon as they get to that area where they can spend, the first thing they spend on is more nutrient-rich food. And that's regardless of where you are in the world, that statistic holds true. And that has had a dramatic effect on countries like Canada, because it has been the big pull, so to speak, on our exports for really about the last 20 years or 25 years as Canada has grown those food exports. They've been in those classes of where people are pulling on that that type of product. As we get beyond that, and many of the cities in Asia are now moving beyond that, coastal China for sure, of course Japan long ago, Korea long ago, Taiwan, but much of Asia is now beginning to move into that other category, which is above the $10 a day, and there's where people begin to eat processed foods. And the diet dramatically changes and becomes, again, not necessarily more nutrient-rich, but it draws on the same products, the vegetable oil and the meats and the dairy.
And it taps into a different segment of the producer economy as well.
It does. It begins to become, we have to look at the processing side of that. And that's a question mark which we can address at some point, maybe later. But certainly Canada performs better in the two to three dollar to $9 or $10 category, where they're pulling on our raw materials, you know, than it does on the further processed, because we're not as good at the further processed. In fact, we have a significant trade deficit of our own in further processed foods. In things we would call processed foods and beverages, it's about a $6.3 billion trade deficit with the rest of the world, whereas in our total ag, when we throw that back in and we add up all our raw materials and our primary processing, we have about a $11 billion trade surplus with the rest of the world. So you can sense what the world wants from us and what we're good at producing. But I do see that as becoming more problematic as we go forward, because the growing markets that are importing the food, and with the income rise, they're going to be demanding more and more of that food to be somewhat processed.
So the increasing intensification of animal agriculture then is going to lead to has already, as you've spoken about previously, led to a number of challenges for the global population, not even just as in terms of economic questions. Could you speak about that?
That's one of the biggest conundrums, is that we have this tremendous demand for more nutrient-rich food, which meat and dairy products provide in the right amounts. They obviously are okay for the body, but too much is no good, and too little is maybe problematic in certain circumstances. But the issue really is it does require a lot of other agricultural resources in order to grow that meat or dairy, and and it's varying degrees. But you know, chicken we can do nowadays for about 1.3, 1.4, 1.5. You know, in the best circumstances, of amount of pounds of grain, and you can produce a pound of chicken meat. So it's fairly efficient in terms of changing the one into the other. Fish even better. Pork is a little higher, and it can be done better than three in some cases, but three is a good number. 3 pounds of grain, and when you get to meat production, it depends entirely on the type of system that's used for meat production. If you don't have a lot of natural grass for the animal, and if the animal doesn't spend a lot of time on grass, then it's going to take a lot, like 8 pounds or more grain to produce beef. But of course, grain is not the normal diet for a cow. I mean, that's why he has so many stomachs, is because the cow is a miraculous thing, really. Is you know, it's been able to convert cellulose to, you know, energy and protein in a way that nothing else can do. Animals with the ruminant animals with the that capacity. So man has had a hard time emulating that in any technological way, although we are trying with, you know, various types of bioreactors and things. But the reality is that one depends, you have to say, on how meat is produced. For example, if you have a grass raised animal, then it's a fairly natural thing, because most people don't understand that in the vast grasslands of the world, we always had ruminants. And if we take the ruminants off the grasslands are in trouble. They environmentally can't exist without ruminants. So it's the two are interlocked, so to speak, in a very natural cycle. However, the way we produce a lot of beef today is we raise it partially on grass, or in some countries, you know, with dairy production, they have very limited grass, and they try to raise it entirely on grains. And that's more problematic. Not only is it more difficult, but the animal itself has to be accustomed to the amount of grain you give it. So it depends on the system, but generally speaking, yes, the least efficient producer, if you're using grain, is a cow.
And in terms of some of the challenges of increasing the volume produced, not only the feed supply applies into this math, but also the concentration. So could you speak about the concentration of animal livestock populations around the world?
That's another big issue. In Canada, we live in really an amazing environment where we, generally speaking, don't have that problem. You know, we have a really limited number of animals for the amount of arable land. In much of the world where we're suggesting that this food is growing, and in fact, all the tremendous growth in these animals has all taken place virtually entirely in the emerging markets. So we see, you know, we've seen essentially a doubling of the number of food animals in the world in about the last 25 years, and it's going to probably, at the rate it's going, double again in the next 20. But this is occurring in areas that are already have significant numbers of animals per square kilometer. And the second problem is they have different variety of different species in this on the same footprint. So, for example, if you looked at a map of Asia and you mapped the chicken population, and you overlaid on that the hog population, that's about half the hogs in the world, for example, in China alone. So well over half, you know, between 500 and 600 million hogs at least in China. But, you know, and one of the largest chicken and duck populations. But those are animals are all living side by side, along with very, you know, significant concentration of people. So the issue then becomes, how do you keep diseases from transferring? So as we sit in the world today, it's very odd, because this is the first time since the 19th century that we've actually had an increase in infectious disease. And about 75% of all these diseases that we're seeing at the hospitals are due to zoonotic. So they're essentially coming from animals. And
we're talking about the swine flu and the avian flu and things like that.
Yeah, and you have so many other examples. You know, for example, people don't think of BSE as that, but that's what BSE is as well. It's essentially it's moving back and forth between animals and people. Most of these diseases are not one way. These diseases are frequently two ways, and very often, in particular the swine ones, it's people to swine rather than swine to people, and then spreading and mixing with the swine and back into people. So when you look at the genomics of these diseases, it's you see within the last one we have H1N1. You know, you could see within that human genomic markers, pig genomic markers, and avian genomic markers, all in that one disease. So that disease has been moving back and forth between those species. And that's essentially the problem. So you've got not enough land and a heavy concentration of animals, and we're bringing the concept to that we want more animals. So the... for example, in China, we're seeing for the first time quite a dramatic change in the sense we had a large hog population. These were backyard farms with, you know, three and four pigs in a family farm. But as the cities grew and pushed these things further, they didn't want the pigs in the cities as much. Although when I first went there, they were abundantly in the cities. But they've been pushed out more and more. And now they're beginning to get the idea they're going to transfer over to the type of large animal operations that we have in North America and Europe. And so they're going from a subsistence type of raising hogs, where in for all intents and purposes, the hog in China was literally the piggy bank of the family. There was no banking system, and you know, if you needed you needed funds, you took the hog to market, and that was your funds. Or if you had a crisis with a famine or something, you had your three hogs, so you weren't going to die. That is really going rapidly, but those hogs didn't eat much grain, hardly any. Nobody could afford to buy grain for them. Those hogs were the green bucks of society. They were the ultimate recycling machine. And that was the, you know, if you look at the social purpose of a hog, that's what his purpose was. It recycled. They're moving from that sustainable system, because they were afraid of the disease primarily, because big cities had no room for hogs anymore. They're pushing them out in the countryside, but they're building these large hog units, and they're emulating our system. But there's one fundamental problem, and that is that China's maxed out on corn production already. So now you're seeing China go from an exporter of corn in the last 10 years to an importer of corn. And where's the only place in the world they can get that much corn from? The United States. It's the only major large exporter of corn. There is corn available in other countries that can send it out, like Argentina and in parts of America, but nowhere nearly to the extent the U.S. can. So it's very, for me, it's a very problem. I've had these discussions with some Chinese colleagues and officials and people like that, and I always raise the question, I said, so you're actually creating a more sustainable agriculture by becoming dependent on the United States for corn? And they look at me and they say, well, you know, we want to have self-sufficiency. Well, I don't think that's the way to do it.
Relying on
imports. Be a little more careful in what you're doing, because we've had a crisis this year, as you know, in the corn production in the United States, where if we all kept using the same demand requirements, just stayed right on track, we would run out of corn this year in the world sometime between May and August. We'll just run out, regardless of what the production is in South America. But what's happening, of course, is, you know, that we're seeing the world respond, you know, to the crisis. And as the price, as the cost has gone up, people have the consumption has gone down in many areas. So we're seeing less use in biofuel, only to the maximum you would expect, or the minimum you would expect. Sorry, with the standards on blending standards, we're seeing animals cut back, so we're seeing dropping numbers of in both hogs and cattle, and it's directly related to the cost. So we've learned a key lesson here, that it's the meat system and the whole system is more elastic than we thought it was, because we always thought to a degree meat was more inelastic, that people would eat it anyway. Well, it's not true. They are changing, but that's the essential problem, or we say that it's a conundrum. How do we increase this meat production in order to keep up with the demand, which is there, if we're going to be able to keep up with demand, at the same time, without coming up with significant downsides, one of which is animal disease, and another which is environmental issues, because they're equally problematic. You know, we get lots of environmental issues that with the any kind of concentration of agriculture, whether it's crop or animal.
And from from our certainly our North American perspective and European perspective as well, there's another issue in terms of the concentrating animals. W5 recently aired a show where they received some hidden camera footage that was shot inside a hog farm, a Manitoba hog farm, Puritone's farm, and the conditions were described by a number of different people within and without the industry in different terms, but we'll get to that in a minute. But the hogs were kept in gestation crates, very small confined quarters, which many on this program and otherwise would describe as too close for comfort, shall we say. And I'm wondering, is this essentially living assembly line, is how they described it, is this an accurate assessment of the pork industry across Canada as a rule, or was that our gestation crates and that kind of concentration the exception?
Well, I mean, it's like anything. There's extremes, and the issue around, you know, hog production has been how do you do it in both an efficient manner and in a manner where the welfare of the animal is of key concern. So there's got to be some sort of way of doing this, because there's no simple answer to this. The system where you allow those animals that are in those gestation crates, those are sows. And the problem with sows is they don't like really being with other pigs when they're waiting for birth. They just don't like it. And they're much happier on their own. So it's not entirely I've heard the arguments on both sides, by the way, and I actually have no position other than, well, let's try to figure out how we make the animal as most comfortable, no stress, less stress, because, you know, the natural environment for a hog is very stressful. But that's the one thing everybody forgets. You know, if we say, well, let's just put them all outside. Well, that's not a great idea in Canada, in Western Canada, in the wintertime, for example. It'd be quite distressful if they all got frozen. But the natural environment is a very tough place to live, you know, for animals. We would have to start over with a entirely different hog, too, of course, because the ones we have today would all get sunburned outside. But so we'd have to put some hair back on them, you know, darker hair probably than they have. But the real issue is there are advantages in those crates, because the hog is feeling less threatened by the other animals. The disadvantage of those crates is that if they're not well looked after in those crates, they can have problems. But any system can be a good system or a bad system depending how the animal's looked after. So if you move them into the new types of operations where they're given more space and the sows are together, this isn't going to be perfect either. In fact, there's a fair bit of money being spent right now to understand the psychology of those animals and how they can react to it. And are they going to be healthier? Because many companies, many of the big companies, have all committed to moving. And most are moving sometime between 2017 and 2022. I'm not aware of any of them that are outliers in that. They're all moving in the direction at the moment, pretty much in that direction. There's one or two chose not to, but they essentially, I think, their peer pressures will and consumer pressure will move them there anyway, whether it's good or bad. But that's the strange thing. We don't actually know whether we're really doing the hogs that much of a favor. But the issue with the actual operating systems are how good are the operators and what happens. We know that the hog industry was going through a total mess in the last 9 months or so, where essentially meat prices had not risen, but the grain prices had doubled, essentially. And so most of these people were going bankrupt, laying off staff. In fact, the one that was that got that much press, they were already in receivership. And I guess the question was, you know, well so who's really looking after them? The people probably all got their resumes out looking for some other place to go. Because I think it had been run fairly well up until the crises. But you got to remember is the other thing. I checked around a little bit to learn, and the chap that was involved in that had been there for a long time, and only got really about 8 minutes of footage out of the long time he was there, And some of those things you're going to see will happen in nature as well as in a place like that. There's no way you can, for example, deal with a prolapse once you get a hog with a prolapse. The only thing you can do that's decent is to kill that hog. And you should kill it in a manner that is no pain to the animal. Unfortunately, it's not good TV footage to kill animals. I mean, but you have to do that because the animal's suffering. And so I have two, my key criticism would be that once you see suffering, you must deal with it immediately, and you should do everything you can to prevent that. So if an animal is not getting enough food, by the way, too, that's the other thing. The animal if it's not getting food and not getting it at the time it's used to getting it, particularly a sow will get very, very upset. And so they fall into a pattern. And just, you know, certain things don't happen at a certain time, that's the way it is. I have a cat at home. He's about the same. If he doesn't get fed at the right time of day, he gets very upset.
So, my dog's the same way. Yeah, you know, absolutely.
And if there's something around that they can hurt themselves on, that will happen. But there are some things that are just good management practices regardless of the system. And unfortunately, you know, we have good managers and bad managers in the system. I'm sure it'll get fixed, though.
I expect you're right. You're right that Puritone was in receivership prior to that filming, so it could be they probably couldn't pay as much for technicians as they might mm-hmm. have otherwise, which leads to substandard staffing. Yeah. I mean, there are all sorts of contributing factors, so it's hard to assess it perfectly cleanly, but there are certainly other considerations. They spoke to the president of the Canadian Federation of Humane Societies, who said that of gestation crates and this kind of farming, she said, quote, "This is the cost of cheap pork, first of all." And she also said, quote, "Canadians are not used to seeing this." She didn't say, "These are terrible conditions," or "Look at how these animals are being treated." Mm. She said, "Canadians aren't used to seeing this." So is part of the issue just the fact that we as consumers are so far removed from the production of meat?
Yes, I think, you mean, if consumers had to go and get their own meat, they probably wouldn't see that as too problematic.
They'd probably go hungry first.
They would most make go hungry, but eventually you would find people would. I mean, we have changed immensely in just in one generation here, where it was not uncommon for people. The majority of Canadians lived on the farm in the last generation. Now they live in a city, just like the rest of the world. But you move both physically and mentally away from that. And so you people don't have a conception of that. If you're going to have any system that produces meat or dairy, at the end of it, you're going to have a death of an animal. There's no way of getting around it. The issue is going to be when they were on a farm, people, didn't think that was a problem. They respected the animal and treated the animal with tremendous care. I've never seen people who are more empathetic to animals than some of the farm people that I know quite well. They are very empathetic to the animals, but they understand the animal's role. You know, its role in society is actually to feed someone and help feed someone and clothe someone, and it has been that way, you know, for thousands of years. The issue is as we get divorced from that, then it's difficult to put in front of people who have never seen how their food is produced the fact that that animal eventually is going to be killed. That's where the real problem, I think, is. And the key to difference is how you respect the animal and treat the animal so that the welfare and the stress level of that animal at any given time is kept actually lower probably than it would be in nature if you just let nature take its course. You know, it's pretty rough watching the videos on a Sunday afternoon of some African safari thing or something, because that's real nature. You know, and in real nature, a lot of animals starve to death. You know, a very gruesome way to go. But I think it's fundamentally that we have removed ourselves from the farm and the food. So we still eat food, but, you know, that process has a downside, and that downside is that you have to kill animals.
So how do we bridge those two schools of thought or those two modes of consideration then? The industry insiders all took a look at this footage and said, there are some things this company is doing incorrectly,
That's right.
We don't support those, but overall this is hog farming in Canada. And outsiders, regular Canadians who have never seen a pig farm before in their lives, were shocked. How do we bridge those considerations so either average Canadians better understand and accept what it is they're buying when they're buying pork, or the industry better accommodates the concerns of the... I don't know which is which. I'm just trying to find a middle point.
You know, I think it's all about being completely transparent and having that discussion, you know, in a transparent way. I don't think anything but good comes of that. It's the problem is developed because the industry... not through any design, but the industry has not been essentially on public display. So there's a difference grows between the consumer and the industry. I think whether it's chicken farming, hog farming, or cattle ranching, whatever you want, there's the same issue essentially at the bottom of it.
Even tomato farming, in terms of the chemicals that are used in.
That's another one. I think there's a tremendous value on simply being far more transparent in everything that goes on. And then let the discussion occur, because I think you'll get a discussion rather than a debate, in a sense. You may eventually get a debate, but I think you'll get a healthy discussion if people are aware of what actually is, you know, how food is being produced. And it's not a bad discussion. Industry has the more sophisticated part of it is you learn not to fear that, but to invite it. You've seen some of that recently, you know, with companies getting smarter about how to handle it. It's better to go up and discuss what you're doing and be very open about it. Because one thing for sure, you would get far more, people very upset if suddenly, their food supply became short. That would be that's the one thing that causes revolutions, you know, is food supply becoming short. And and we're seeing it around the world just with high prices, you know, because this one was more rationed by price. And you've had, how many governments now have fallen, largely due to the latent issue was always there, but the spark that set it off, you know, particularly through North Africa and the Middle East, et cetera, that spark was the fact that your food cost more than doubled, and 80% of the income of some of these people in these countries was going to food. So suddenly they couldn't eat, and suddenly, you know, political issues that were a problem one day became a crisis. So we live in a bit of a too easy of an environment, and life is too easy. But the points you're raising are good points, and they simply need to be discussed, you know, rather than people yelling at each other and or people, you know, saying things. Some of the things I've heard about the farming are really simply a total lack of understanding, particularly the ones that, I wouldn't eat beef because, it's somehow raised in a manner that's destroying the earth. And I think about that and I go, 25% of the land mass of Canada is grassland. So if you take all the beef off that grassland, what are you going to put back? Are you going to put the bison back? Because we had more bison, you know, than we have beef today, far more. And that was a highly sustainable environment. And the problem would be, if you're going to take the animals off the grass, what are you going to do with the grass to preserve it? Because it won't preserve on its own. It'll catch fire. It won't be well manured. It has all kinds of issues. You know, there's plenty of good, you know, peer-reviewed material that suggests that ecology is rapidly destroyed if you don't. Having too many animals on it will do the same, you know. So there's a balance in nature. And so getting people to have a good discussion, you know, rather than a well-informed discussion, that's everything. But the farm community has a really big issue because they don't know how to bring this forward. They're trying to figure it. They're actually beginning the process, because I've been to two or three of these large seminars where they have, and they talk about, how do we open up? And they use a wrong word. They want to educate consumers, but it's not so much educating consumers as is being just transparent about what you're doing, and let the consumers educate themselves. And the but it's a two-way street, and the and I think that we are making some huge strides. If you, if you've been to some of the meetings I've been at the last little while, where the farm community is saying, well, how do we do this right? How do we, you know, get consumers to understand that some of this is actually very, very humane and, in fact, far less stressful on the animal than would be if I just threw the thing outside and said, here, you know, I'll throw you some feed in the morning. It's that's very stressful.
I'll bet. So you've spoken about the size of the meat production industry in Canada and even around the world, but ultimately it's the result of human consumption patterns. Mm-hmm. So you quote Rajendra Pachauri, who's the head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, who said, quote, please eat less meat. Mm-hmm. Meat is very carbon intensive, he says.
That's right.
So I have two questions for you. How resource intensive is meat, really? We touched on that a little mm-hmm. earlier. And how realistic is his suggestion that we eat less meat?
Well, it depends who we is in that equation, right? Because you've got a lot of the world that has hardly any meat and is, in a sense, undernourished. And a little bit of meat in their diet will go a long way to helping them. And so the increase, the world is increasing in meat consumption, but at the same time that's happening, the per capita meat consumption in North America is dropping like a stone. I mean, it's about half of what it was, you know, 30 years ago. So it's come down dramatically, particularly on beef and pork, and it's stayed it's maybe risen slightly, but not a lot on chicken. Whereas in the rest of the world, meat consumption is rising very rapidly on a per capita basis, and with larger populations, so meat consumption is rising. So we have this conundrum. North Americans are already doing what he's saying. They're eating less meat. So that's and we're producing. The other thing he missed, because he said that about 4 years ago now. And the other thing he missed was that we're producing meat extremely efficiently relative to the old statistics used. So the average numbers that you were using earlier and I was using earlier are average numbers. But in North America, you know, we produce this this stuff for a fraction of the carbon that we used to, because we have essentially better genetics. So the animals are actually pack on the meat in a much more a better way, because they absorb more nutrient from the feed that they're eating. That's been an enormous change, just like almost like a second grain revolution, if you wish, is the fact that the genomics has changed in pigs, and has changed in cattle, and has changed in chickens, and essentially that change has been to allow them to take up the feed in a more efficient manner, get more out of it. That is a secondary benefit, because that means the manure has less problems in what's going into the ground, because so much more has been taken out. So phosphate is a big change in that. So he didn't fully understand that, because we've made huge strides, but I think I don't think he fully understood the fact that North Americans have dropped in their meat consumption and Europeans considerably. So when he's saying that, he's talking really to a large degree about the emerging world, and I'm not so sure he's really giving them a good prescription there, because one of the key advantages of meat is that it has and has always been this way. It's a way of storing grain over a long period of time. You know, so historically, they didn't have grain bins, you know, places like that to store. In fact, that would become completely problematic if we tried to build enough storage to keep this grain, because it eventually, you know, deteriorates. So what we learned was that animals were a great place to store unwanted food that you couldn't consume at the time, could be stored in animals. And so, you know, the only way we'll ever survive a disaster in the world in the near term will be if we run out of grain, we'll have the animals, at least until we get to the next crop or when we can produce one. That's still a valid thing, and particularly in the rest of the world, you know, where if you look at parts of Africa and parts of Asia, that's a big deal. You know, so I have a hard time imagining that we're going to actually all consume less meat and therefore we're going to somehow have more, you know, more to eat. That's illogical, and particularly in a world where, you know, it's not unlike Canada. very large portions of South America and Africa, particularly as well as North America, are grassland. So what is the logical conclusion if I take the animals off all that grassland? I just logically can't get beyond that, because I think he's failing to understand that. And the second issue is a lot of the crop that's grown, the part that goes into the animal production for the most part is part that we won't eat. You know, it's downgraded grain. It's not what you're making your bread out of. It's that stuff goes at a higher price. That's not to say that we aren't interchanging it because we have so much acreage of corn, but he's on a very fine point there that we have to be conscious that there's no right or wrong answer to that one. But I do agree that it would help if North Americans and Europeans ate less meat in the way they're doing now. I think they're getting to a better balanced diet, and if people who have no meat in their diet probably ate a little more meat, they would have a better and more nutritious diet. So I think it's more of a balance issue, and I think he's overplaying the hand. I'm a little more concerned about the concept that we've taken the same amount of corn that the United States used to export, and we've turned that into biofuel. I mean, I have more of an issue with that than because I think that was a fairly unnecessary addition to the fuel supply, because there's virtually no difference in the amount of fuel that we actually have to use. It's a drop in the bucket compared to the oil system, whereas it has had a significant change in corn, because we've moved from around $2.50 a bushel for the last 20 or 30 years, give or take 50 cents a bushel, to over $5. So we've doubled essentially the price of one of the most, the main ingredient that goes into animals in that period of time. So suddenly we've got a whole new normal, which is double what has been, you know, for the last 25 or 30 years. That is much more of an issue, I think, even though it's very obvious that that's not the driver of high price. It just happened to be thrown into it's like the last log on the pile. The driver of high price corn, it would have come anyway, is diet change and population growth. But in the midst of diet change and population growth, we had this other, you know, one-off that came out of nowhere, and that was, oh, I'm going to take the same amount that I used to export out of the United States, and I'm going to turn that into fuel. So that was the straw that kind of broke the camel's back in a sense in terms of pricing.
Well, I'm glad you bridged to biofuel, because that was actually my next question, so I don't even need to ask it. But I am curious about the diversion of corn from animal feed into biofuel, and in the context of international trade and reliance, China's newfound reliance on the United States, the United States' reliance on China. Mm-hmm. Do you suppose that was just a strategy in terms of international trade and spiking commodity prices for the benefit of one or the other? Or do you think that's a conspiracy theory?
I don't know. I think it's just a welcome happenstance for many people that I don't think if you went out to create that theory you'd be successful, but the way it happened was pretty straightforward. As I said earlier, the Chinese wanted self-sufficiency in meat. The thing that's always created the most instability in China is essentially when there's a food shortage, and the food shortage in China is always the prominent thing they think about is not rice, but pork. So rice is also there, but pork is the real issue, because in northern China it's grains and in southern China it's rice. But everywhere in China, what goes with it is pork. So if you're going to if you suddenly run out of pork, you're going to have a countryside that's really difficult to deal with. The Chinese already have all kinds of issues in their countryside, you know, today, and mostly through the responses to growth in that area and people feeling that their rights have been, you know, taken over or abused. They don't need a pork shortage. So the government set out with a vengeance to produce pork. And as I said, they produce half the pork or more than half the pork in the world. But in doing so, and particularly in moving from the small farm to the large units that we have in North America and Europe, in the modernization, so to speak, of that system, they have had to reinvent that system. And part of that is a reliance on corn. There are other things you can feed. You can feed them wheat. You can feed them barley, and those are perfectly good. But generally speaking, the currency of international trade in that sort of thing in animal feed is corn. And so that automatically, when they made that decision, they were also making a decision to become more reliant on the United States. Now, I don't think they totally agree with that, you know, because they believe they can increase their corn production. And there is some data that in certain areas of China they can do that with more nutrient inland. They've probably got over-nutrient already in the coastal areas. But the problem with it is a lot of these areas that we're looking at that they have to do that in are very dry, and they're getting drier. And so the other side of this is there is an uphill battle because some of the biggest areas in the world that currently produce grain are slated to have more issues with global warming, climate change, and a slight increase in already warm areas that produce corn. Like if you increase the temperature by just 2 degrees Celsius, which is the current target that we were on, you know, is going. That 2 degrees Celsius, even with the best genetics we know today, will reduce corn by about 5% in right across the board. So if you're already warm. Now, if you're in Canada, if you're in southern Manitoba, which is interestingly shifting from a wheat economy to a corn economy, very few people know that, but it's happening as of our eyes, you're going to be okay because that warming will actually help you. But if you're in Kansas or Oklahoma and you're used to producing corn, guess what? You know, that 2 degrees is going to put you to the point where your yields are going to start dropping, in particularly even more so on wheat, where that 2 degrees is more like a 10% drop in your yields. So you can imagine that we're going to need tremendous increases in science around yields just to offset the change in climate, just to keep us where we are.
Do you think changes in agricultural technology can keep up with climate change?
It's a huge question that, you know, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the UN, tried to answer. There's a great piece, you can go in and read about that. They've had two or three cracks at this, and they did a rewrite of it in their kind of their balance sheet, so to speak, of what it's going to look like going forward. They did a rewrite of that last summer. And in the end, they come out with the answer, yes, we can make it, because technically we can do this, 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 and this. But in that technical argument, I see this as too many technically, yes, we can achieve that or we can achieve this, but there's very, very little, if any, sense that they're all built on assumptions that even though these are scientifically achievable and we can do these certain things, there's very little about, you know, what are all the unintended consequences of all these things. That's hardly mentioned. And the fact that things just generally don't work out the way, you know, if you can draw this pretty picture and assume the world is going to move that way, I think it's asking for too many stars to line up in the same direction. So I'd say technically we should be able to do it. I mean, if nothing else, just the argument that we can reduce, you know, George Morris Center produced a paper just recently and said, you know, we practically waste about a third of the food we produce. So just don't waste a third of the food we can produce. We can get ourselves, you know, halfway there. Well, you know, that's one thing to say that, and it's another thing to, which I agree is true, but how do you do it? You know, how do you do it? Because food is wasted at every stage of production. And I don't see that ever changing. I mean, we may be able to reduce it from a third to, you know, 20% or something, but there's no way that you're going to be able to, because food is downgraded for a whole bunch of different reasons. You know, you can have bad things happen while it's being harvested and all of a sudden all that's gone, or it's in storage too long, or it gets infested with something, and if we go forward in the future, we're probably not going to be able to use the same chemicals we can use on it to preserve it or to keep it from being infested or whatever. And when it, you know, gets to the house, you know, half the time it goes bad in the refrigerator. So I don't think people are going to get any smarter about it, you know, other than the fact that it's going to get more expensive and that will kind of bring their attention to it. But it does suggest to you that when anybody sets out to prove mathematically that you can produce it by bringing X amount of land into production, by increasing yields by so much, by drilling wells deeper or whatever, all these things have to line up. And then the issue about climate change is a huge unknown, because they're continuing to assume that it's just going to increase 2 degrees. Well, you know, unfortunately, we're getting a lot of arguments saying, "Well, I don't think so. I think we could go well beyond that," which is then it's completely unknown what would happen.
So, with so many pressures on our food supply, in terms of quantity, quality, price, et cetera, there have been a number. Well, and even the quality certainly. There have been a number of responses. There's certainly vegetarian and veganism. There's the organic movement. There's the local eating movement. Which, if any of these, do you think is the most appropriate strategy in North America, or do you suppose we should just eat less?
I really think all the strategies are important. I wouldn't point to any one of them as being the way to go. I really think that, again, the whole issue is that we need to keep talking about this, and we need to push the facts very hard, you know, get the data right as best as we know it, because it will continue to change. We learn more all the time. There's a lot of issues that we haven't even touched on that are all these other unintended consequences around the system. We've just touched on them. Big ones that are in the window all the time, but there's plenty, and I think the key is that no one way is going to work for everybody everywhere. It's because populations are different, and particularly the way we need to raise food in different parts of the world is different. So nobody wants to be completely dependent on somebody else for their food. I mean, that's a dangerous situation.
Even though we city dwellers have all accepted that fate.
Yes, to a large degree we have. We've accepted it, but we're depending on what we see as our neighbors. They just don't live in the city. They live in the countryside. And we conveniently, you know, can stretch local to mean almost anything. So for most of my career, I spent looking at how do we move surpluses somewhere. And we got very good at finding markets and moving surpluses to them. I see us now moving into much more turbulent times, where sometimes we still have surpluses, but a lot of times now, you know, we're looking at scarcity. So, and with these big boxes around us, producing more while doing less harm, that becomes an amazingly difficult problem.
That was food industry executive Ted Billier speaking about global agricultural economics, some of the many challenges of food production, and considerations for responsible consumption. To close this episode of The Public, we'll hear one of my favorite bands, Picastro, playing Meat. The Public is a weekly conversation about ideas and undercurrents in Canadian culture on CIUT 89.5. If you have something you'd like to add, please be in touch. You can find us at thepublicconversation.blogspot.ca or through ciut.fm. You can also email us at thepublicconversation@gmail.com. That's our show this week. We hope you'll tune in again. Just hope.